several, there's one of them, certified foster home. And also approval of foster homes. And so, it used to be that if somebody denied it, you could go to the circuit court of the county where the foster home regarding which was located and so on and so on. So as you'll notice in section 18, we have merely cut that out and put in that they can go to the court of appeals as provided in 183-480. I doubt very much if we'll ever have any cases, believe, facing, you know, when somebody really takes one through. But if it is, then you don't tie up circuit court time with a thing like this. You hold the agency here. Same way with section 19 on children's, that was foster homes and also children's services division on daycare centers. It is of a little more interest as they come about, but you can get the same procedure as hospital certification or anything else. Agency hearing.
Before you go too fast,
yeah.
Section 18.
Yeah.
This is, what is the, what are these 418-65-645?
Foster homes.
So if there's an order of the court awarding custody and control to, that isn't.
No, this is
the
just.
The trial court sends wardship and places a child in the foster home. That isn't it. What are we talking about?
Welfare certified certain homes as proper.
Oh, and the home
foster
home.
Home.
The home's appealing from the decertification.
From
the
a decertification or denial.
Oh.
Nothing to do with the custody. Just, is this a proper foster home?
How many have they had of these?
None that I know of. Certainly nothing that we certainly have ever had any cases on it. It's sitting there.
Should we put it in a separate bill and put an emergency clause?
Okay.
No, it has nothing to do with that problem. It really has to do with this a proper foster home. Same way with the daycare center situation, which is 17, 18, and 19. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Section 20, 21, 22, and 23. Racing commission. Don't see any language in that anywhere till you get about page 16. Now, this merely says that before refusing to license any applicant for a race meet license, the commission shall afford the applicant an opportunity for hearing after reasonable notice as provided in 183-310-500. If that wasn't there, the fact, you'd have to do it anyway under the APA, but now it's there. It says it. That's all left for. New language, section 21, still racing commission. They can exclude people from any and all race courses who may deem detrimental to the best interests of racing or who willfully violate some sort of the present law. This section says they may take that action without first providing a hearing and without being subject to criminal or civil liability. If no, in other words, they need to act fast sometimes on that situation. If no hearing is provided, within 10 days after their action, upon demand, they're going to grant the guy a hearing as provided in the APA, but they got to give it to him fast, no later than 20 days following demand. Now, this was Racing's request.
Is it possible that having given the hearing after the action was taken, that others who would benefit by the action taken will be deprived of some procedural right by granting the hearing? In other words, it's sort of like a teeter-totter. You send, you know, I'm going to send you up in the air. The other side's got to go down.
Is that a
potential consequence here for you? More than one person?
I can't see that that would be. This is only, if you look at the first part of line 23, this excludes a person. You're thinking if somebody who has come to the commission and says, that guy's a baddie for racing, excluding from the meet. All right. And they do it right then and there. Then he grants him a hearing. Okay, who's going to be hurt? The person
okay,
that wanted
him. Actually, there isn't anyone with a correlative
injury. I don't think there's anyone who has a really correlative injury. This
okay.
is just, okay, fella, you can't be around racing. It's okay, if he's a jockey, it may be very necessary, you know, who somebody thinks is.
And then on the hearing after the action, if body reverses itself, the racing commission reverses itself, potentially that reversing can occur before further
damage it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's the theory behind it.
That's the theory behind it, and it's subject to review.
Yeah, for the
10-day
rate.
For the 10-day rate, right. I agree.
Fishing commission signs on tears.
Okay, revocation, section 22 is revocation of license to hold race meat. You'll notice in subsection 3, this shall be made only after a summary hearing before the commission will put 3 days' notice in writing. Shall be given to the licensee specifying the grounds for proposed revocation. Okay, we just changed that to reasonable notice and opportunity for hearing is provided in ORS. So, which under the Trade Administrative Procedure Act hearing.
Is 3 days' notice used elsewhere?
I don't believe so, to my knowledge. Okay, I think that takes care of racing. Does it? No, 23 is still racing. Oh, you're the Board of Stewards. Person adversely affected by a ruling has the right to appeal commission and hearing as provided in 183.310. Perfected by.
What are stewards?
I think the judges are these for each meet that are appointed. Okay.
Need Hollingsworth here to get the technical.
All right, now let's see. Now we come down to the bottom of page 18. It's the Board of Pharmacy and Pharmacy. This is if the actual licensee and delinquent are not paid, he shall be reinstated as follows upon payment, that he shall receive a temporary permit. This was a request of the Board of Pharmacy. While I was cleaning up the APA, they felt that this, if we could get this in.
Cancellation on 9/11 is permitted.
Yeah.
Is that because cancellation or suspension or revocation? Otherwise, it works as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it just expires. It just expires. Request to take that out. Do we have to go through the formal act of cancellation? If we don't have cancellation in there, we know it expires. And the following language says if you didn't pay it, then you're going to be reinstated. And that. All of 171 is about.
For a question, is this a good bill?
Yes, I believe it's a good bill.
I move that amendment to conform to 2132.
Any objection?
He's going to be over here tomorrow to explain his amendments to the porno.
Oh, no, he's not. Not unless dragged.
I've got
the mail. I don't know why he didn't do it last year.
Quite frankly, Bob, I'll tell you this. When you stop to think, I think a lot of this is a result, not this subsidies matters, but the other addition. We kept, through the 2 year period, from September 9th on, notices of conflict that we would come up with. This is where they'd arrive. I kind of kept a file on it. And really, in going through it really with a fine-tuned comb, I'm amazed how much we did hit in the conforming the Enabling Act. Now you don't have, hopefully, if somebody goes into a agency chapter, he's going to be referred back to APA by the section itself, as well as by just, oh, I better carry in my mind the fact that I got to check the Administrative Procedure Act. Thank you.
On the pornography thing, seriously, I'm sending a letter to movie theater operators, and if you have to propose amendments, which would out the
coming in there, to really
turn it on the bill.
I don't. The only thing that I have done, but Representative Hanson, you have far more lengthy trial familiarity with prosecution of obscenity. Might as well live.
Oh, yes, you remember.
So ordered on the amendments. Mr. Bunn moves Senate Bill 171 is amended to the floor. First call or roll. Senator 171.
Aye.
Aye.
Mark.
Aye.
Paul.
Aye.
Wilson.
Aye.
Mr.
Chairman. Aye. Motion carried. Senator order to make Mr. Hampton aware.
Thank you. If I, if you heard,
just a real quick one. Those bills on live sex shows and making pornographic movies, are we going to get that stuff? I thought the one tomorrow was on movie theater, so.
What's their deal?
Well, this should meet at 1:00 tomorrow or 2:00 tomorrow.
Meet at 1:00 tomorrow or 2:00 tomorrow.
Don't you want to get us the live sex shows and all that?
I haven't seen the shows yet.
496.
Good point.
Let that feel true.
496 deletes, deletes authority to fingerprint photograph when a child is replaced with legal custody of TSD.
Move was passed it out.
Hold on. Which one? 496.
Good bill should pass.
I don't know, we got to keep records on everyone.
Radical legislation.
If Dan and their report can't know it.
Wally's report.
I'd like to debate
it. I made a note of this, and it's great, but I think we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bath. They admit that when a child is in place in a training school, they would routinely ask for the fingerprinting. And they have to go back to the court, and the court, one of the witnesses said, would pro forma just issue a standing order that in all these cases that's what's going to happen. But you've got to have the courts in 36 counties throughout the state come up with a formal order saying we're going to do that as a matter of routine in every case of commitment to training school. Why should we force the courts to go through all that administrative trivia if by statute we can just say that it applies to training school instead of Children's Service Division where a child is placed in training school?
So moved.
I don't know. They didn't come in and object to it.
Yeah.
No, but I don't.
They made that point.
I made the point with the witness. Who was it?
Carol.
Hart. Half the Barkman. The Barbell.
Well, they might be the child has been placed in legal custody of the training school.
Yeah. I assume training school, a juvenile training school, isn't there a certain...
Is a child placed in the legal custody of the training
school? If placed in legal custody, they have to.
Yeah, they get the legal custody just like corrections get legal custody of an adult offender.
Okay, then placed in the training school.
It has to be placed in the training school.
What I'm trying to do is avoid making the court just go through automatic, like it's going to be done all the time that we have a life sentence.
It would be a juvenile training school. Exactly. Turn you want to use.
Well, that's what I move to.
What do you do? What are you moving to do?
So it'll be, okay, I would restore, first of all, restore the deleted matter on lines 11 and 12. Having thus restored the deleted matter, delete the word on line 11, the legal custody of the children hyphen, and delete line 12 and insert, where a child has been placed in a juvenile training school.
Where a child has been placed in a juvenile training school. Mm-hmm. That's the correct terminology.
Well, I want to double check. I think that's the term we use for the purpose.
Juvenile training facility or school?
Oh, holy mackerel.
And that's
called
school.
Whatever it's referred to in here.
Yeah, but, and that's
still in ways you need to get ahead and tell
you. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and 162-135, for the purposes of, we define juvenile training school to mean McLaren School for Boys, Hillcrest School of Oregon, any other school established by law for similar purposes, includes other camp programs maintained under ORS Chapter 4.1.
We have a question of identifying who was in custody and who escaped,
you know,
and
Yeah, well, maybe we ought to think about that.
Yeah. Okay. Don thinks we ought to think about those buildings. Well, look, if it's my only purpose in making that is relieve the court of having to go through, you know, a needless function. You know, if it's going to create me problems, I don't want to do it.
There are children in my training school that are sent up to the court because they're running.
Now.
Yeah.
Right.
And I can't just rely on the fingerprints alone.
finances where they're, when they're put out there just because there is no other place for them.
Well, that's the insurance.
The court rules, what?
Yeah. Dixon, Lewis.
Do they still do it though?
Don't you think Grant and Hart may have overstated that a little bit when he said just as a matter of routine they're going to order these fingerprints?
I just took his word for it, because I remember
that. They might and they might not, depending on the circumstance of the case. There may be a necessity for fingerprints.
The unused care centers are in 420.
I tell you what, why don't we leave it with him and try it. If it loads up the court, let him come screaming in next time and say, do it routinely, and if they aren't, then we'll have waived this in the favor of the child. What's that? I think Brian moved Gross Senate Bill 496 to the floor of the due pass. First call the roll.
Oh.
Aye, Peter.
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
It's now 2:30. We will take up 2370. Such order of business.
What's 2370?
Well, then
all of them.
We'll get it tonight. 2370, or unless Mr. Bowen takes 10 minutes and we can get out.
Yeah, I don't want to take me about 10 minutes.
You have in your book somewhere in Hand and Growth 2370 that we've been working on. Yeah, but they gutted it.
That was bad.
It used to be a good bill.
Well, we'll put it back and send it up. Where do you want to start? At the very beginning or on page 4?
Where do you get this book? Well, everybody's got this.
I've got a contract.
Oh,
hey,
well,
you
got
somebody.
I have
the answer. Can't find mine. Why is he somewhere?
We can all see in the dark.
Well, as I recall, we got through this.
Yeah, there are a couple of specific changes that need made, if I can suggest them, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
On page 4, where it says, notwithstanding, on section 6, where the Hand and Growth copy says, notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 192.005 to 192.1070, that's the wrong ORS citation. It should be 181.010 to 181.065.
Line again.
The line on page 4, line 11, beginning of section 6. You should have Hand and Growth, notwithstanding the provision of.
It should be instead of
what it's got there, it should be 181.010 to 181.065. Okay, then some additional changes. Page 5. Where we had on Hand and Growth, Oregon State Police, that should just be deleted. I think we deleted it last time, but I'm not sure.
Where was this?
On page 5, line 12, 14, and 14, delete Oregon State Police. Reinstate the original language.
Reinstate agency. How about on line 12?
Yes, on line 12 and 14.
What should it be?
Oh, it should, on line... Excuse me, on line 11 and 12, the original language should be reinstated. Okay, then there was some question on line 32.
The propriety?
The propriety, right. If there wouldn't be better to replace that with some other language.
Someone indicated that that was confusing or not clear as to what that means.
Justification?
How about the proving need of purging? Is that all right?
Proving need is a higher degree.
How about justification?
And for burden of proving that what is purging or changing that purging or changing internal information is necessary.
Well, why should you have to prove necessity?
Well, I'm just trying to find a word.
Oh, yeah.
I have a limited vocabulary.
Well, would it be appropriate to leave propriety, or is that just confusing? Justification, probably.
That serves us well in other areas.
What he's doing, really.
Yeah, time honored phrase.
Yeah, everybody understands it.
So he does prove the propriety. What does that prove?
It's not happening.
Well, the point is that in hearing, if he appeals and asks for further hearing, we're making it clear as to whether it's the
agency.
You
deleted the APA.
Well, the only reason we deleted the APA is because Bob Lundy from Legislative Council indicated that it would automatically apply.
It would automatically?
Right.
Then why do we even have six at all then?
Well, because we need to make it clear that when that thing...
The appeal would be by the individual.
Right. But is it clear that it would be the individual?
Who has the burden on the APA? The APA succeeds. Why should we change the burden?
Well, we felt... I don't have any strong feelings, but we felt that it should be the individual's responsibility to show that agency action was improper. I certainly don't have any strong feelings if the committee wants to just be silent on that.
Well, now what happens then under six if the commission refuses?
Supposedly, then it goes to the.
Yeah, where does it go then?
APA.
APA.
Goes through the APA.
Automatically, according to.
Well, yeah. Now this is just from Bob Lundy. We deleted the reference to APA because Bob Lundy indicated that it would go through the APA the way the statutes are set up now. Now, if you think it's wise for us to put that back in, Don, you should. How about just deleting six, George?
Fine. I don't think it's necessary, really.
If it goes under APA, that ought to take care of it.
Okay. I would just suggest deletion of six.
Delete six.
Okay.
That would change the other subsection accordingly.
Correct. Then the next problem area in section 10, well, excuse me, on page 6, the section that was originally numbered section 11.
It's now 10,
but it's now 9. Anyway, the point on that section is that we wanted to make it very clear that the commission had standing or whatever is needed to go to court for injunctive relief against actions by a part of the computer system. And we didn't say that clearly here, and I wondered if we could plug in language that would do that.
The commission may issue an order to remove any information that the system that fails to comply with regulations imposed. The commission is entitled to judicial enforcement It's removal of any non-complying information.
Of the removal.
Of the removal.
And you see, all that's giving them power for is to remove information, and they really need the power to stop the abuse or ask the court to stop the abuse.
What do you ask for a what? A injunction?
Yeah, we just want to be ready to allow for
including we had injunctive relief in there once.
Well, the point, yeah, we had the commission is entitled to injunctive relief to enforce the suspension.
Well, we could just say judicial enforcement of the removal of any non-complying information, including injunctive relief.
Okay, would that injunctive relief go beyond removal and doesn't that commission really need the power to force them to desist from the kind, that kind of action?
Well, your sub one says the commission may issue an order to remove any information.
Right, and that really isn't what we wanted.
What we wanted?
What we wanted was
to enforce
power,
the provisions of this act.
Right, that's what we wanted. For that commission to get the court or somebody to say you can't do those kinds of wrong acts.
The commission may enforce the any provision of this act or a rule promulgated pursuant thereto by
court action.
Whatever the appropriate language be, including injunctive relief. That's
right,
what you're
that's
getting
that's what we
want. Why? I don't know if the compliance too broad. Maybe the commission is entitled to enforce injunctive relief to compliance with this act. I'm not, frankly said, I'm not that familiar as you are with it, so I'll probably use it at this point.
Well, I'm not familiar with how you plug language in to get the kind of injunctive relief that you need, but what George suggested, I think, is all right.
Okay.
I
understand what we're talking about, Don.
Yeah, on the injunctive relief, I don't have your language, but I know.
We don't have
anything.
Well,
just
look at
that.
Old 11. Now 9 to state somewhat that the commission may enforce compliance with the provisions of this act by appropriate court action, including injunctive relief. Is that the
fine? Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Then the next question on page 7, lines 12 and 13. Says relating to an arrest concerning where there is no prosecution initiated in a court within 1 year from the arrest or outcome of which is acquittal, dismissal, or refusal.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask the question of the committee, is a year's time for initiation of prosecution or court action too long a time period after arrest before you would require a purging, or is the 1 year period about the right time? About 60 days, 30 days, actually, so it should be the fluid that we pour in there.
Where there is no prosecution initiated.
Yeah.
After arrest.
Of course, that's merely regards to holding her in
something
incarcerated in here.
We had to do it so that it's
Well, the 30 days relates to an indictment after the person is held to answer, or and the 60 days is if he's in custody, he has to be tried within 60 days.
This is where he's in 1 year of arrest.
I would think if he isn't prosecuted in less than a year, why the case isn't very good. Okay, I just wanted to draw that to your attention, if that looks all right. Some things to be sure that we get on page 8, in line 18, we change from a fine of $300 to being guilty of a Class C misdemeanor. Then on lines 26 and 27 of that same page, be plugged in at the beginning, notwithstanding the provisions of ORS 44.040, which relate to doctor, patient, attorney, client, et cetera, types of privileges. And went on to say that the violator except the judge shall not be entitled to further privilege, because the judge is concerned about that. And then on the...
Can I speak on this? Just for a minute. Now, you'd be entitled to exemplary damages for negligence. And to my knowledge, there isn't any counterpart to this anywhere in the law where you, for an act of simple negligence, would be entitled to punitive damages. In other words, sub 2 treats a willful violation
same as the negligent
one. And I wonder if that's good law.
I don't. Well, I see problems with it. I don't think that a negligent violation should be treated in the same way.
No.
I share your concern.
We just delete
negligent.
And we shall, in addition to any liability,
How about just saying a willful violation?
Or I think
cutting out
intentional
or
would be even better.
Intentional.
He wouldn't be liable for a negligence violation.
But he wouldn't be liable for exemplary damage.
Well, evidently, as I understand it, the judges are very protective of the kinds of
the right to be arbitrary.
The privilege
and
I guess.
The willful violation, not justification.
I think when you taking the negligent out, the argument for a judge exception becomes pretty minimal. I have no objection to leaving him.
Well, we read then, notwithstanding ORS 44040, if it is found in each action that there has occurred an intentional violation, the violator shall not be entitled to claim any privilege in the rest of the agreement.
Mm-hmm. You put the judge back, you took the exception to the judge.
I would take the judge out.
Then on the final page of the bill is attached a section 20 which was added that says that Senate Bill 516 becomes law, that it will replace the commission we had proposed in the bill, and that the definitions that follow in section 21 will replace the definitions earlier in the bill. Senate Bill 516, I got copies for the members of the committee, it has passed both houses and will go to the governor for signature. And the reason that we plugged that bill in, well, the point is, if the governor would veto it for any reason, I don't think there's a problem. But
well, that's that data processing
bill,
isn't it?
Right. And I've looked at this bill, and you can glance it over, and I don't think there's anything in the bill that would conflict with our idea, even though the bill is designed for a different purpose. If our bill passes, the governor could simply look at this and appoint people with the idea in mind that House Bill 2370 is also passed.
My one concern is that 516 creates advisory committee. The powers posed in your bill here in 2370 go beyond merely explaining
is that anything you need to worry about?
Well, the only thing, as I understand it, even though that indicates to the advisory committee, there would be nothing in the law that would prohibit it from exercising these kinds of powers if we, by legislation, enact those kinds of powers. It would be better for us to have that language.
And it's all set up and funded.
Now, there's one other comment in addition to that that I should make that goes right to the heart of the bill that we still haven't resolved, and that's on page 4. section 7, our definition of intelligence data and what's excluded. And what I suggest there is that we pass the bill as we've got it written and recognize that we may have to work with the law enforcement officials, several members of our committee, to go to the Senate committee and ask for amendments that would clarify exactly what kinds of intelligence information will not be allowed on this system and what will be allowed. But it's my concern that in order to pass the bill, it's more important to make it clear that we want those types of information excluded unless law enforcement specifically justifies particular areas. And the law enforcement people have been working for months, as I understand it, on rules that would specify what kind of information would be allowed, and I think that we could go to the Senate with their ideas on that, but I would recommend passage of the bill with our amendment.
You're talking about Section 7?
Yes. Section 7, sub 2, where it says in the handed and gross copy, no system shall contain any intelligence information indexed by the name of an individual that has the potential of culminating in any criminal charges, etc. Do you have that on your... And I think that's probably the major area of controversy in the bill.
How about the definition of criminal information? Consider using, which you saw on page 2,
we just
criminal computerized criminal history.
We changed the definition as we were running through this to simply say that it was computerized criminal history.
Now this is on the definition of system, you mean?
No, excuse me. I thought
what
you were
is
talking
it
about criminal information.
Information.
When we were talking about criminal information earlier, George, we decided to delete everything except computerized criminal history. That would be the definition of criminal information.
Well, yeah, and then section 21 on page 9 defines it as well.
Okay, that would have to be modified also to conform with our earlier changes. To cut out statistical information and then just say computerized criminal history.
Well, in that case, then you don't necessarily want section 21 to be the same as Senate Bill 516. It was my understanding that 21 was to be enacted in 516.
That's right. It is.
Only because it establishes the commission.
That's the only reason, not for any of the other definitions.
No,
okay.
Just to establish it. Commission.
So sub 2 on section 21 has to be, the definition of computerized criminal history would have to be changed.
Well, no, what we would say is criminal information includes the following types of criminal justice information files. No, criminal information should simply be defined as computerized criminal history.
Criminal information means computerized criminal history.
Right.
What I'm saying is the definition of computerized criminal history. Well, those are out, I'm all right.
Okay, now while we're on this, now
so we'll have to move
instead of the way you've done this on page 9, since it has passed both houses, shouldn't we just take this section 21 and move it up to, as you changed it, and make that section 1?
I think that would just, if that's the way to do it.
About the
government,
I doubt
very
much
that we're
good.
It doesn't change
the same. There is, this is kind of with his blessing, I think, because it's something he's been working on for a year or two.
Why don't we do that?
Okay. I'll move the amendment.
Could I ask one question on page 7 now? Does this include all of the handwritten language that appears on page 7? Is this all still in?
Yes.
Okay.
Except some of the numbers may be changed
there
because of the renumbering.
I'll call it for the amendment. Any further discussion? Questions? call roll, or is there objection? So ordered. The bun moves 2370 as amended to the floor of the dispatch. First call roll.
Can I say something?
Yes, further discussion.
I don't know. I know it's going to pass anyway, but I just think the whole thing is just a mistake of sorts. The point is that if anyone wants that information, have it. But as far as I can tell from the testimony, no evidence has been indicated that we need it. And I'm not even certain that if we did need it, that this would be able to solve the problem. And I don't like to pass bills that simply don't have a need for it. And by saying that this may happen or this may not happen in the past law, I can think of a thousand things that might or might not happen. If they worry, and we could be here for 5 or 6 years trying to solve all those things that may happen. I don't think it's a thing on software or something like that can provide more security and still this type of will provide people on the access to people. Or certain terminals to the information that do farm work. So for that reason, I'm going to vote no.
Okay.
And there won't be.
Clerk, call the roll.
Ben.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Jack. Mark.
Aye.
Paul.
Aye.
No.
Yes.
Walter?
No.
No. Motion carries. Bum carries. You want to look real quick at 599? Or 499, I mean.
That's the 18-year-old, too, in the contract. Okay, too.
Move Senate Bill 499 to the floor to be passed recommendation.
The 8th and majority bill, they're the same thing, doesn't it?
Has it passed both houses?
Mm-hmm. Will it?
Probably no, they didn't change that.
Brought
by.
Oh, they didn't do that.
Clerk,
call the roll.
We don't show any conflicts with that of the bill.
Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Ben?
Aye.
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 Mark?
Aye.
Aye.
I expect that it's hard. The government will hold it as long as he can. If the other bill passes, it'll be for this one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I sense that you people want to sleep.
7 p.m. tonight.
7 o'clock. 7 o'clock.
Be prompt because we have a guardianship law to go through right at 7.
Well, if you read it.
I'll wait to pass these out later.
Thank you. Janet, we do, and the judge, and Billy come to the table, and we'll
pick a bill to decide how it goes.
Did you bring 245 with you?
I did.
You have 245 with you tonight?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, there's a couple things in regard to that before we go into the guardianship. Well, one of them has to do with a couple of suggested amendments which I think the committee has before under cover of letter of Chief Byrne.
I can tell you about that if I may be permitted. Mr. Snitzer is in the same building that I am, and his feeling was that the section as it stands now requires the personal representative personally to deliver or mail
all those things
to
write
the note
in front of you.
And would not permit
your agenda,
the personal representative to do so
right
through his agent or attorney. And his idea was to change the language so there could be no question of what an agent of the personal representative should make the delivery or mail it.
Okay, you'll find the amendment to section 25 on page 10 of Senate Bill 245.
And his other suggestion was...
Let's take one at a time.
Oh,
so
all right.
The committee can see what we're doing here. Page 10, line 8. We delete the words deliver or mail and insert cost to be delivered or mailed. Would sound like a reasonable amendment.
No objection to
it again, George.
Yes, on line 8, you deliver delete the words deliver or mail and insert cause to be delivered or mailed. Is any objection to that amendment? So, next one?
The next one relates to ORS 113-145.
That's the one we just looked at. Yeah. The next one's 116.
Oh, next one's 116.
093, which we'll find on the page. Well, that particular section apparently isn't amended in the bill.
Well, ORS 116-093 says that the personal representative shall cause a copy of the notice to be mailed. And he wants to insert to be delivered or mailed. His idea is that many attorneys office in the same building, and rather than having to go through the post office, it would be just as easy to drop down or up to the attorney's office and hand it to him as to put it in the mail. In fact, it would be quicker and more expedient. And I can't envision any objection to that.
There's still a requirement for the affidavit to still have to file an affidavit, don't you, Judge?
Yes.
To indicate the mailing and delivery has been done.
But his idea was that, for instance, two lawyers in the same building, to have to put it in the mail is rather ridiculous and would reach the addressee a day or two later than the actual delivery.
Okay, any objection to that?
Well, now, that means now we'll have to write this in as a new section.
Yeah.
One other thing, Mr. Chairman. Will there be any amendment of the affidavit statute making reference to delivery or just to mailing? If there is, counsel can handle that, I suppose. But that's implicit in our amendment.
Yeah,
that's
I don't think it requires any change.
Oh, okay.
We'll take a look at
you think it. Might?
Mr. Bond, did you have a question in regard to this bill?
Yes, I wanted to ask.
116-093.
He says 116-093.
What's the tag?
Sub 2 and 3. The notice need not be mailed to the person representative. I feel it ought to say the notice need not be delivered or mailed to the PR. And sub 3, proof of the mailing to the person entitled shall be made by affidavit. To be consistent, you'd have to say proof of the delivery or mailing.
Well, we'll have to adjust their meaning.
Okay, that's
true.
Oh,
yeah. We'll take care of that. Mr. Bunn has a question.
I have a question for the judge. You had made comments earlier that we had a a relatively well-working system that you consider better than Idaho's.
Yeah.
And working better. The letters that I have received for probate reform, I looked them over yesterday, and with the exception of one, they came from people who had just gone through the experience of probate in the state. And their concern was the amount of time and the cost. And I may be completely wrong in this, but it's one example, an 81-year-old lady who went to one attorney to have the estate probated, her husband, went through the process of almost completing it. Her attorney was disbarred. The claim was turned over to another attorney who finished it up by writing a letter accompanying the material, and she was charged $400 on a small estate. Now, I simply can't believe that that is equity or a good system or is doing what the citizens of Oregon need. Now, that may be a case that happens only 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 1,000,000 or something, but without exception, these people have complained about the high cost and the amount of time. Now, you've explained to us the time problem, but do you believe that the costs are just, and is the bar doing anything about allowing the cost to come down to what I would consider to be a reasonable level?
Well, let me answer your question by saying this. There's no law in the world that is going to protect all of the people against all of the rascals that abound. Now, I don't know what the particular problem was in that estate because it isn't clear from what you said, but I've known attorneys who offer estates for probate when the only asset was a piece of real property owned as tenants by the inheritors, and no probate was required at all. I've also known attorneys to include property owned by the entirety in the inventory and charge a fee based on the full value of the property. I'm not able to tell you what the bar is doing specifically, but I know that when the scandalous acts of attorneys are called to the attention of the grievance committee, they do follow through very diligently and try to right the matter. And I do know that the attorneys have a fund that they contribute to make good the losses of persons that are put upon and injured. Reforming the law isn't going to change the circumstance that you mentioned. I can't conceive of the law having anything to do with that problem.
Mr. Chairman, one further question in that regard. I went into some detail in a couple of these cases, and the lady I mentioned whose earlier attorney had been disbarred was told by the subsequent attorney that there was nothing he could do about the fee he had charged because the bar required a minimum fee and he had to charge that much money in order to probate the estate. Now, I may not, I don't know the law in this area, but are there minimum bars?
The bar has a schedule of minimum fees that they charge in the state. That's advisory, it's not compulsory.
Yeah. Representative Hampton's correspondent from Washington County introduced the bill standing soon in business affairs today. And the Fresno Oregon State Bar came in and they just testified before that committee that the minimum fees are now advisory rather than mandatory.
They are advisory.
Yes, that's right.
We have some other amendments, Janet. I don't know where they came from. We're headed legislative council on June 5th, which want to amend this bill to take care of the district court library fees.
Those came from Representative Hansel.
Yeah, do we want to people put those in the bill? Anything else down here that we can stick them in? I thought we had a library fee bill. What was that?
Part of the problem is we notice the time where this bill is quite broad in order to encompass all of the things that we intended to take care of. And so I think that that was the idea. They were trying to use it as a vehicle for the decision.
But there's nothing.
Oh, yeah, pure and simple. That's,
yeah.
That's
and it will fit within the time.
To use this bill to take care of this
yeah.
one particular item, which is to.
What it
a
does then includes it would include the district court or add the district court to the requirement that you collect the library fees. don't know if we want to get into that now. If not, we might take it up later. Shannon, why don't you go on to them?
There he is.
Is there any further questions on 245?
And legislative council.
But it's headed by a letter from Corey Byler and Rue.
Oh.
It represents Hansel and Tony Cohen. We'll take that up at a later time. Any more questions on 245? All right, let's go to 407. Dan, I think the best way to proceed is you just pick right off and just be as concise as possible. We'd appreciate it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I need a document, I might say, but this is a complete revision of the guardianship conservatorship law. The old law has been completely repealed except for the provision establishing authority for a public guardian. And there are amendments to those to take into account the new language that is adopted in this revision. At the start, it's important to keep in mind certain definitions because the definitions change the concept a little bit.
Is this outline you've given us, is that a complete outline of the whole bill?
What it does is go section by section and show a comparison of the section in the bill with present line.
I think if the committee would refer to that and she goes along, it probably would save some time and have it before you at the office of legislative council. Go right ahead.
One of the important aspects of the revision is that it takes, under the former law, there were three areas. There was a guardian of the person, a guardian of the estate, and a conservatorship. And what happened in this revision is that we've limited now to a guardian and a conservatorship, so that whenever there's any property to be administered, a conservatorship is created, whether it's for a minor or for an incapacitated person. If a person is incapacitated and needs care and custody of him, a guardian is appointed, and also a guardian is appointed by a minor.
So it would be a conservatorship whenever there's any property involved. What if you have an incompetent person with an estate?
You can have a joint proceeding.
You have to have a guardianship and a conservatorship proceeding together?
A conservator can act as a guardian as well. It can be both. And you can combine proceedings in one.
It doesn't have to be separate filings?
No. The proceeding here will reach the authorized.
Okay, far away.
Mr. Gilley has compiled a little history of the sections. 60 of the... Well, there are 83 sections that really are involved in the revision. The rest are housekeeping provisions that are necessary due to change in definitions. 60 sections came to me from Feldec Code. 14 were old ORS sections that we felt were valuable and needed to be included. Four, the committee drafted. They were their thoughts and they were completely original. And five were a combination of all three. A little bit smaller. So to get an idea, basically it's uniform probate code. You'll notice going through the definitions, some of the key definitions, of course, are conservator, guardian, incapacitated person. And it's important to keep in mind the difference between an incapacitated person and a protected person. An incapacitated person is one who's unable to care for himself or his property, so he needs the appointment of a guardian. And a protected person is one for whom a conservator has been appointed. And there are the reasons for a protected proceedings are set out in further on in the bill. But they have to do with a person with an estate that's incapable of administering this estate for one reason or another. And the reasons are enumerated later on.
Now, if you have a minor, for example, you're going to appoint a guardian. It would still be a guardianship proceeding.
Right.
But if you're involved with an and state it all, does it then become a protective proceeding?
No.
Or a protective and guardianship proceeding?
If you want to provide some of the active guardian to take care of the custody of the minor and so forth, then you have to combine the two. The first part of this bill deals with this. Oh, we have a problem. In that house in Senate, we had defined minor to include, we had it more general. We had it as the age of majority. They felt that because of the problem last session, the problem is open when the bill was passed last session, which authorized minor or persons over the age of 18 entering the contract. And what would happen was that they would still be subject to the guardianship under 21, and yet they could contract to convey the real property.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd be a time period that they really couldn't. They'd still be under the guardianship, and there was a conflict between the two. So they wanted to lower it to 18 years, but they didn't take into account the unmarried, the married person who was under 18 years of age. So if after the word means any, you insert unmarried, that would clarify the situation. Because a person under the age of 18 is married is considered incomplete.
Minor means any unmarried person?
Yes.
Who is, okay, I understand.
Would it be as accurate to say minor means any person who has not achieved majority?
Well, that is what we had originally, but the Senate felt that because of the problems with the person of majority, that they would rather spell it out in this bill. That's what we had initially, because we felt that whatever they lowered the age of majority through the session, then it would automatically take care of it, and we wouldn't have to be worrying about it as it went through.
Okay.
Okay.
The next section deals with notice. And this is just a procedure for notice. For all of the proceedings under here, wherever notice is required. Section 3 authorizes a person who is entitled to receive notice to waive notice in writing. Section 4, this is the section that authorizes consolidation of proceedings if you have a guardianship and conservatorship at the same time. Section 5 is a facility of payment for minors. If you have personal property with a value of less than $5,000, any person, it can be paid $5,000 per year without the appointment of a guardian to someone either with whom the minor resides, to the guardian, or a financial institution. And because of the amendments in the Senate regarding the age of majority, line 28 should be deleted.
Deleted?
This is line 28 on page 3.
Right.
The 18 is no longer mine. Section 6 is a provision which authorizes a parent to designate a temporary guardian through a power of attorney. This would only last for 6 months. It limits the powers, of course, of a temporary guardian, too. Section 7 establishes the preferences in appointing a guardian. Gives the parent the first preference, and then the additional preferences are set forward. Section 8 just establishes the form for letters of guardianship. Section 9 deals with guardians. We start with provisions that deal solely with the guardians of minors.
Is there a separate form for temporary? There's a temporary guardianship.
You mean the ones that are parents?
Or is there a temporary guardian? I know now you can get a temporary appointment for 90 days, I guess it is, while you're awaiting services citation.
There are provisions here for a temporary appointment, but we didn't put a form in for the letters at all. Section 9 provides that the guardianship begins upon appointment and continues until it's terminated without regard to the location of a minor, which means that a guardian can take him out of state. That's one of the flexibilities that this provision provides, is that a guardian can be out of state and can report. The reporting procedures and everything are a lot easier here for an out of state guardian. Section 10 establishes venue. Section 11 is the procedure for appointment. In subsection 1, designates the person to whom notice is required to be given. Subsection 2 deals with the requirements of the person to be appointed. The test that the judge must use in determining. And subsection 3 is a provision for a temporary appointment, for appointment of a temporary guardian, and this will can last no longer than 6 months. And subsection 4 authorizes the appointment of an attorney.
Is it 6 months?
Right.
That's temporary.
That's line 18. That's a temporary guardian.
No, I'm looking at you here. Page 4 of the explanation, I guess I was looking at you. What page are we on?
Page
6, subsection 3 of 11.
Oh, you're describing existing law. Okay. I have an explanation. That's what I'm talking about.
Section 12, you'll notice that there was a similar provision included in the probate bill. This requires a guardian, upon acceptance of his appointment, to submit himself to the jurisdiction of the court of the state in all matters dealing with the guardianship. And this is done so that he can live out of state and he can be served out of state and subject service. Section 13. There's another amendment that should be inserted here too. Section 20 is a similar provision for a guardian of an incapacitated person, and in that, in order to make it clear to a person who's not familiar with this, that an out-of-state guardian, the out-of-state guardian provision, we inserted the language, whether or not a resident of the state, whether a resident or non-resident of this state, after appointment, after the word of guardian,
well,
yeah, by accepting appointment, you delete as guardian. Mm-hmm. And after a guardian, you say whether a resident or non-resident of the state.
So it read, by accepting appointment, a guardian, whether resident or non-resident.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say of the state?
I think so.
Doesn't make much difference, does it? Not just being prominent.
Not yet in the United States, and I don't know. Maybe.
Go ahead.
Section 13 deals with the powers and duties of the guardian of the minor, and basically this is to take possession of the paid custody of the board to provide for his education and his material needs. And they receive money under the facility of payment section of the section 5. Compel the performance of compel anyone that has a duty to support the board to do so. Take proceedings to compel him to assume his responsibility. And basically, he has to act as, in the capacity of a parent.
What kind of proceedings do you contemplate?
What kind of proceedings?
The board proceedings to the district attorney's office, probably.
he's reporting to the ward, to the court. You will notice in line D, is as ordered by the court. This will allow the court some flexibility for guardians that he knows are quite responsible. The reporting will not have to be as frequent as for those who feel the need to watch over the court.
You don't have the annual report on that.
Guardian of the person.
Yeah. Guardian of the person.
Very good.
Oh, I don't have a plan code. You don't have to.
Guardian of the receiver.
Okay. I think the court can ask for a report on the status.
Any subsection 2 requires the guardian to apply any money or property received on behalf of the ward to the ward's current needs to support care and education, and then to conserve any excess. And other provisions in regard to the use of this money. Section 14 deals with the termination of appointment and guardian. And the death, resignation, or removal of the guardian, or the minor's death, is adoption, marriage, or attainment of majority. Section 15 has to do with subsequent proceedings and will authorize a court. It authorizes concurrent jurisdiction with the appointing court and the court wherever the minor is residing. This will facilitate the out of state guardian, guardianship to the ward out of state. Section 16 is the procedure for resignation and removal proceedings. This is where the court is petitioned for removal of guardian for cause. Or also when the guardian requests, this is the procedure that is to be followed. The next article deals with guardian.
Why do you, well, the ward is 14 years to be procedural. Okay, I guess.
And you notice that any person interested in the welfare of the ward also, that the neighbor or anyone that is concerned about the situation. I think that's a little broader than present law. This has to do with the guardian of incapacitated persons. It's a person who is unable to care for himself or his personal affairs. The venue is the same, whether he resides or is present. Section 18 sets out the procedure for the appointment of a guardian. You'll notice that the incapacitated person or anyone interested in his welfare can initiate the petition. Then notice in subsection 2. Subsection 3 authorizes the court to have the incapacitated person examined by a physician. Subsection 4 is a unique provision in that it authorizes the court to appoint a visitor. A visitor is included in the definition, and this is really a disinterested person. And the court can ask anyone to go and interview any of the persons who knew may appear as to the status of the person involved in the petition. And subsection 5 allows...
It's contemplated that the notice will not be in the form of an order of the court to appear and show cause, or just be a letter from the petitioning guardian.
It was the attempt of the committee to keep the notice
Section 2 also just notice means information concerning the proceedings.
Right, and that can be as informal as the court will allow.
So you don't contemplate the an actual order of the court deciding this.
I think that when this matter was discussed by the advisory committee, so many cases that this involves, it's just a family matter, and all the families can come in rather informally and take care of it. And you know that everyone's been notified without going through the formal procedure, and this will allow the court the flexibility that it needs. And still trying to meet constitutional standards. We do specify the person that has to be notified in the proceedings. And each article in the bill, the person to be notified is set forth for each of the different classifications.
No, are they going to come up with new forms? Barner, I suppose, in our black book, what comes to with it?
We've been invited to prepare a summary of the Act and its provisions and the amendments to the probate code, and also to prepare forms to submit to the bar at its convention in October, and we plan to do so.
Beautiful.
Okay.
That question you raised is interesting. The present law allows for both, apparently, or requires it. Even in a pure person's guardianship, but I guess it's not often enforced. But then it has a sub 2 which says the guardian of the person shall give a copy of each report to the guardian of the estate, if any, for the reward. As if there were two of one, 26 and 20. The way you have it here, totally discretionary. And the court isn't going to require that annual reporting unless it's for good reason. That's the way it's intended. That makes more sense, really.
Well, we're speaking now, of course, only of the guardianship of the person.
Yeah.
That's the
distinction I'm trying to make. Yeah. But we're in the rest home situation.
Serving a citation on the manager of the rest home doesn't mean much. Blush every time I do it.
Okay. Subsection 5 authorizes the court to require that the person alleged to be incapacitated has a right to request. And section 19 has to do with the findings of the court and the order. Section 20 is similar to the section 12 that we discussed earlier regarding subjecting the guardian to the jurisdiction of this court by accepting appointment. Section 21 is dealing with termination again, and it sets forth based on which guardianship terminates. And then set forth the procedure for removal or resignation in section 22 and 23.
There's a winding up period, I assume, or something like
that. Section 23 allows the guardian some protection in any claim or in any decision filed for his removal, and requires the court to follow the same procedures as in an original petition. It not only protects the guardian, but it also protects the ward. Section 24 is the section dealing with a designation of to whom notice has to be given for both the appointment or the removal of a guardian. This, once again, the guardian of an incapacitated person. And this designates the person that has received notice. Section 25 authorizes appointment of a temporary guardian to an incapacitated person. And the grounds for this are if an emergency exists or if the present guardian is not functioning effectively.
Excuse me, could you wait a second? I was trying to pick up on. In section 24, I take it, serve the ward, and the person has actual care of custody. Would that be the nursing home administrator in the case of an aging person the way it is today? That's his point.
We can wait now to talk about it.
What do we do?
The duties of the temporary guardian would be limited to those that were specified in the court order. Section 26 has to do with the enumeration of powers and duties of the guardian. And they have to do with having custody of the ward, providing for his care, comfort and maintenance, consenting to medical treatment, and of course the conservator has not been appointed and he can compel any person to pay sums for the welfare of the ward and receive money. And if the conservator has been appointed, then he requires to turn the assets of the ward over to the conservator. Subsection 3 requires a guardian to give bonds, court requires. This is discretionary with the court.
Well, that's a rather, that's pretty big departure from existing law, isn't it? That's a real step forward.
This is, remember, this is in connection with the appointment of a guardian of
person.
Yeah. It has nothing to do with the conservatorship.
I know, but we've had judges in our county just say adamantly, and the only reason the person just, you must have a bond.
And Section 27 provides for concurrent jurisdiction in subsequent proceedings with the court of another state, wherever the guardian and the warden reside. Article 4 has to do with protection of the property of persons who are under the ceiling in minor. The rest of the bill has to do with the powers of the conservator and appointment of the conservator. Section 28 is the section dealing with protective proceedings, and this is the purpose for which protective order may be issued and a conservator appointed. If it's a minor, and the court determines that he has property and that he has property that needs management, or he has business affairs which are jeopardized by his minority, or he needs funds for his support or support of those protection is necessary, then a guardian, a conservatorship will be appointed.
And have you back up to 27 and say. But on the concurrent jurisdiction commission for purposes of resignation, removal, accounting, and other proceedings. Do I read into that possibility to have to file accounting in both courts?
I think the idea was to allow the county administrator
to transfer the jurisdiction, you know, even not concurrent.
I have the exact problem now. The mother and her minor son, who was under guardianship in Oregon, moved to Seattle. In Seattle, she remarried. They want to have the guardianship proceedings in Seattle now rather than here in Oregon. This would permit that Seattle court to make an order of appointment and permit the guardian here to send the money to Seattle and take a receipt for it, and that would terminate the proceedings here.
I think subsection 2 is just for the decision.
Yeah, it wouldn't be dual supervision then.
No.
No. subsection 2 of section 28 establishes the basis for the appointment of a conservator for a person other than a minor. And as you can see, this would include the extension of an older person who has his mental capacities possibly physically unable to take care of his property, and someone who is mentally and physically unable. It's quite general in that it would take care of anyone who really is unable to take care of his property. Section 29 is the jurisdiction provision. It gives the court in which the petition is originally filed exclusive jurisdiction for certain purposes, first of all, to determine who has jurisdiction, and and to determine the need for conservator at that point. It's strictly a jurisdictional section. Section 30 is the venue provision, and it authorizes venue in a place where, in this state, where he resides. If he doesn't reside in the state, then in the place where he has property. Section 31 deals with a problem where proceedings are started in more than one county, and puts it basically in the county where they were first commenced until we can determine where venue is really, where it belongs. This is an ORS provision, this is not an ECC. Section 32 is the transfer of guardianship matters and authorizes the court to transfer the proceedings under the circumstances as set forth in this section. Section 33 is the procedure for appointments of subsection 1, be able to make a petition. And you'll notice once again, the person who is protected, any person interested in his estate, or anyone who may be adversely affected by lack of effective management of his estate. So this really is quite broad.
Mr. Chairman, there is taking about 3 minutes here. This goes right on the Zunt bill that's pending, the provisional process remedy. I guess there's really no problem because you afford the notice and hearing requirements of the Snide Act in plenty of cases, but it is noteworthy that I, as a creditor of a debtor who has property in the state, might be fearful that by lack of the debtor's effective management of that property, I would be deprived of payment. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I could seek to be appointed the protector or whatever, conservator.
Right, but then you would have to show that he meets one of these conditions in subsection 2 of section 28. If he's unable to manage his property effectively for mental illness, mental deficiency, physical illness, or disability, age.
Well, I see. It requires 2 plus 1 then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's answered my question. In other words, you can't just go by 1A or 1A alone under section 28. All the money or property is required. If it were a minor alone, then any other person you'd have to fall within the which would be way too ridiculous. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I guess it's you'd have to stretch, I suppose, to claim mental illness, deficiency, disability, age. Might be an alcoholic.
Provided chronic use of drugs and intoxication.
Okay.
Confinement, detention by a foreign power.
Because they're all currently.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting alternative. I guess there's no conflict.
That's straight out of UPC, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's good. It has all the due process requirements of the Snide Act and Plaintiff's case. Mm-hmm. Kind of fascinating. Okay.
Subsection 2, Section 33, set forth the contents of the petition. Section 34 specifies to whom notice must be given. And you'll notice in Subsection 3 that any person who files a request for notice is also included here. And to the person and other persons that the court may direct. This gives the court a little more discretion once again. Section 35 authorizes an interested person to request notice. And Section 36 is the procedure on hearing. Authorize appointment of an attorney. Authorize examination by a physician, too.
Did the county get nervous about that authority to appoint an attorney? Or is it assumed that the attorney would be paid from the whatever state? What do you call the person?
Protected person.
In the
state.
County has kind of been very nervous for a time on other legislation when we speak of appointing attorneys, but it's wondering if they haven't voiced any objections.
Section 37 just is a designation that newly specifies that the powers enumerated in Section 38(4) of this Act can be exercised by the court either through a conservator or directly by the court. And you may want to look at these powers. You may preserve and apply the property of the person while the order is pending. You may use some of the assets to take care of if it involves a minor.
Is it contemplated to be a special court officer, like a juvenile officer or probation officer, to do this?
For example, impounding the fund while the
proceedings are by ordering.
Yes.
Section 40 deals with the powers that can be exercised by the court for court and say it was just a person other than Maya. And I think it's improbable that being as quickly as I can go through them. And they gift, provide the court, convey a release, contingent expectant interest, exercise release charge of trust interest and representative, entering the contract, settling a debt, create trust, exercise options. As you can see, it's quite broad powers.
Do we have authority now for creating trust? I didn't think we did it during the debt. I haven't looked at it recently. Well, it took a lot of time, but that's a real improvement.
Well, that has been one of the problems with the guardianship code now. The investment power and the powers of the guardian have been considered to be very limited. This is an attempt to give them powers that are more in keeping with those that a person representative has in the state. They're much more liberal and much more flexible.
Typical. This, we're talking about avoiding COVID now. We had the case of Daisy and Maja concurrent, jointly administered guardianships of a state, husband and wife. Okay. When we created them, I took great care to set up a bank account for survivorship. As a matter of fact, we called Judge Dixon. He said he didn't know why I couldn't do it, so we did it when they first died, passed it together. But if we hadn't set up, if we were permitted to set up trust because of a perfect cross probate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is kind of a nice thing to do.
A lot of
keep them moving, Dan. Come on, Dan.
Yeah. We're almost through it, really.
You go over these powers very quickly. You don't need to know what they can do. Second border one leaves within the protected person certain powers to look after his own estate, even though a conservator has been appointed, if the protected person is mentally competent. This is in the case of a person, an older person in particular, who is physically able to take care of, and yet there's certain things he can do, and just enumerates those powers. And this is in section 42, one is more powers regarding protective arrangements for the person that the court can exercise directly without the appointment of a conservator. Yeah, in a single transaction, which is important. Like for an older person who has an estate, to be in a nursing home and do a single transaction arrangement for the person who has funds and provide the care.
Annuity contracts, things like that.
We're very proud of that one because it doesn't require the continuance of the conservatorship, you see. It's a one-shot thing, which frequently is the only reason for the appointment in the first place. And once that's accomplished, the proceeding is terminated. I think that's one of the most valuable.
Section 43. Designates a person who may be appointed as conservator and establishes preference. Now, these are preferences in that this once again gives the court discretion in determining the person to be appointed. Section 44 is a bond provision, and here the bond of the conservator is discretionary with the court. He may require a bond, and of course this will have to do with the value of the estate, the credibility of the conservator appointed, and reliability. And this is discretionary. This is new. Section 45, if a bond is required, these are the terms and conditions of the bond. Section 46, similar to the earlier provisions where a person who accepts the appointment of a conservator consents to jurisdiction in this state. Section 47 is the form for letters of conservatorship. Section 44 authorizes compensation and expenses for persons who a visitor, attorney, doctor, anyone else involved in a protected proceeding, and that comes from the state. Section 49 is the death, resignation, removal of a conservator.
Who's a visitor?
A visitor is what one of them is called, a busybody. He's afraid of busybodies. Andy, it is the person that the court picks to go and interview any of the people that have custody.
That's the word of art, it's defined.
May I rise to that fly? In my years on the bench, we found that there were numerous family controversies over who should be guardian of Grandpa, and usually the struggle was for Grandpa's money and not for Grandpa's welfare. This authorizes the court to appoint a disinterested person as visitor to go out to the house and talk to Grandpa and see what the situation really is. That was the real purpose of it.
Section 49 authorizes the court to remove a conservator and accept his resignation. Section 50 authorizes any interested person or other person interested in welfare to petition for any of the following things: a bond, an accounting, distribution. This is just a check on the conservator. Section 51 requires the conservator to file an inventory within 90 days of his appointment. Gives the court discretion to extend the period. Section 52 requires a supplemental inventory of additional property is made known. Section 53 is the accounting provision, and you'll notice this requires an annual accounting unless the court by order provides otherwise. So once again, the court is giving flexibility in the accounting procedures.
One 15 seconds, all you people who hear that, you know, the annual accounting costs are too great in the smallest, take this back home and have put that in the pipe, you know, the smallest state. You can give the judge something that's credible, assure the judge that nobody's going to go south for change.
This designates the person to whom a copy of the accounting is to be sent and the procedure for the accounting. Section 54 authorizes a consent accounting procedure. And this is for a person who is a minor and becomes of age or recovers from a disability. He can account with the conservator can account to him for the administration of the estate without going back to the court.
Or if Papa goes south with the money and Sonny wants to forgive it, he can, and no questions are asked.
Section 55 requires the guardian to file notice of his appointment with the county clerk in any county where real property of the ward is, of the protected person is located. Section 56 authorizes the conservator to take possession of the property of the ward of the protected person. Section 57 deals with conflict of interest, makes the transaction voidable, and provides exceptions. Section 58 provides protection for persons who deal in good faith with a conservator. Section 59 starts with the powers of the conservator in the administration of the estate. He has powers conferred on trustees. He has the duties and powers of a guardian of a minor. And Section 60 is the real big power section, though. Well, if the minor, if there's no one who has parental rights to the minor, then he has the duties and powers of the guardian.
Well, that's one instance where a conservator equals also guardian of the person.
Right.
Oh, great. So you don't have to petition separately for that capacity, the right of operation of law. But for the minor. You wouldn't deal with the minor.
See here, it says it doesn't preclude the appointment of a guardian, but it would give the conservator those powers if he wants them.
So he can just put a pigtail on his petition and say, by the way, make me guardian. Sort of the word that.
For the bank, for instance, wouldn't want to be guardian of the person.
Right. Thank you.
That's good.
He's got a lot of trinkets that really worth while.
Section 60 is the power section, and you'll notice in line 14 that it says that they may act without court authorization or confirmation. And these are the powers that we can exercise.
Operate that business.
I don't think we need to go through anything.
Just the money saver in case you're interested in your client's welfare. No more trips to the courthouse for all these ex parte orders.
Section 61 authorizes distribute income of principal of the state without court authorization, basically to support education and care of protected person. Section 62 authorizes expenditure to reimburse persons for expenditures that they have made to protect a person, and this authorizes advance payment. It's quite a good idea. Section 63 authorizes conservators to make gifts if the estate is substantial enough to take care of it in their gifts. And as charity, or these are charitable gifts. Person might have been expected to make, sorry. That's a new example. Someone might have agreed to pay so much for church every year, and the state is large enough to allow it, but they become incapacitated. And if they've always done this in the past, we can continue to do it.
The grandchildren we just
Section 64 deals with payment of the estate to a certain person who needs a majority. Section 65 is a procedure for on the death of a certain person. Power of duty is conservator. And in subsection 2, note that if a person representative has not been appointed in 40 days after the death, the person conservator can petition for appointment of person
responsible. Excuse me, he doesn't even have to go that far. He can apply to exercise the powers and duties of a personal representative so that the estate of the then decedent is administered in the same proceeding. This is one of the greatest money savers that we find in the bill, I think.
Is there any conflict with the probate?
No, you just shift course and set different parts, setting published notice and go from there. So when you, Judge Dixon?
What?
Once you put on the hat, you did the same proceeding, you just put on the PR's hat and we would.
Correct. Take an order of court giving you success in that stand up.
Very thing we've said, you know, for years. We've tried to explain
the car.
Yeah,
it is.
Why
we're here.
Getting something on the
works and
get up to that
floor.
Go down, do it.
Let that finish.
We're going to use them. I'm
going to
stop
in time. She's talked about this too much, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure she's going to quit anytime.
Section
56 is the court discretion in enlarging the powers of the conservator or limiting them. Section 67 requires the conservator and the court in administering an estate to take into account any estate plan that has been created by the second person. Section 68 deals with claims against the estate. It requires the conservator to pay them upon presentation allowance from authority. And what happens, the procedure for presenting claims is set forth in subsection 2. And subsection 3 deals with this allowance for claims. Section 69 deals with waiver defect in presentation and presenting of claims.
Now this is different from the probate situation we covered before, isn't it?
Right. because in the probate code we took out the reference to defect in form and substance. Does that only have to do with presentation?
I don't remember, but I'll look at it later. It seems like there's some difference, but defect in form and substance or is waiting to presenting the claim. Well, I'll look at it later on.
No, we took out presentation because we felt that it had to be presented within the statutory period. We did the same thing here. We left it the way it was in the old probate code here.
You said 245 provides primary mention. The defect of form of a claim timely presented may be waived. It doesn't provide for waiver of presented.
Section 70 deals with action on the claim can be disallowed, and the exercise of remedies against collateral in Section 71. These are all claims, Section 72. And 73 really exhibits just this notice to the conservative finance appointment in 1973. Section 74 is the claim procedure, the claim is disallowed. Section 75 is the statute of limitation of claim. Section 76 is the force of preferences in payment of claim. Section 77 specifies the liability of the conservator in contract situations. Section 78, termination of the proceeding. Section 79 authorizes summary disposition of the administration of conservatorship for a state under $5,000.
This is the ORF section inflated from 1,000 to 5,000.
The next section authorizes a payment of property in that for foreign prisoner to a foreign prisoner without having to make it a student in order. It's helpful. Section 81, is what is presently in the law regarding the deficit administration. This case in conservatorship, only this has been extended to include the public welfare division. This is done by a member and extended then at the request of the welfare division. Section 82 has to do with the power of attorney that is prepared before a person becomes incompetent, and provides that the power of attorney will continue, and the attorney in fact can go ahead and ask if he would have acted before the person became incapacitated.
There is a clarification on that. Section 3 is the over-present law.
Well, I think that's fair. The terminology is
better. Because I have had people ask me what happened. You know, whether the guardian of the state has the power to invoke it, and I assume, yes, it could be done.
Since they're no longer a guardian of the state, it's a conservator now.
By the way, for the sense of others who say we don't make progress, the important progress came into our law in the 69 revision that took effect in July 1970 and produced by a lot of us to reduce the cost of guardianship on the small.
And Section 83 provides that the death of the principal will not affect the liability of an attorney in fact who acts in good faith without knowledge of the death of the principal.
All the rest of these are amending existing sections. Are there any,
there's one problem.
You want to look at 88?
On page 68. Excuse me.
What page?
On page 68 of the bill, one of the housekeeping provisions.
Page 68.
Instead of amendments, on lines 26 to 28, put the bill out of the scope of the title. I mean, the title and constitutional. So I have an amended title.
Okay. Any other amendments? I move to amend the title of not what other amendments you just told us about.
Gerald, lead it.
Let's see, we wanted to make it on the
right behind
person.
You. You understand all that stuff, don't you?
They talk about death of a prince and they didn't even school.
We've got the mother in there, if you want.
Bill 539 is what you're thinking of.
It's
in the book.
Action.
We had a hearing. I think Senator Roberts testified.
We're going to amend that to knock out those seduction laws altogether.
Only that amends 30.710. We talked about whether or not we should amend the bill to also amend 30.720, but that is not in the bill.
Okay, but
let's
make
the bill.
Well, we were considering deleting the
Well, if you did that, if you made a repealer out of 549, as was discussed, that could still follow through and would not hurt this code at all.
Okay. Oh, you want to hit the rest? Are there any specific amendments to the existing sections that are, you want to point out to? That
no,
are
just
secure?
Those are the ones that we went.
Have you got the amended title there with you?
Yeah.
You might need to take a couple of weeks to review this
correction.
I got it.
Oh,
they're
different.
Right.
While we're mulling over, just in about 20 seconds, a little of the background about this, who worked on this, and how much time went into it.
This bill was prepared by the Advisory Committee on Probate Law Revision. This committee was initiated many, many years ago, and they proposed and drafted the original probate revision that was introduced in the 1969 session. Most of the members on the present advisory committee were the same as those who served many years before. There were some new members at the time, being both in the Institute of Law School was on the committee, and the new members. Doug Fitton was on the committee, Mr. Gilley, Bert Butler, and there were many of them. I don't have the rest of the names.
Howard
Frommeyer.
Tom Goody.
And Allison.
And in addition to that, there were representatives from the Bar Committee too, that served on. And they began this project over a year ago. And the result of their work is SB 245 and SB 407. We had many 2-day meetings. We met at least once a month, and sometimes for over half of that period, the meetings were 2-day meetings.
They did a fantastic job in that short time. Is there objection to the amendment? So
order. Move the bill before it be passed.
I have to move
approve Senate Bill 407 as amended before the due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Glenn?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Pat?
Aye.
Rudy?
Aye.
Mark?
Aye.
Phil?
Aye.
Aye.
What's the number of the
if that doesn't make it unanimous consent calendar, I know Mr. Hanson would just love to share it.
We'll divide it up.
245, let's take another quick look at 245.
Are there any amendments on
my
calendar?
We adopted a couple of amendments.
You have a conflict notice.
Yeah, with Senate Bill 343.
But this repeals the section of the taking that was amended in 343. 343 is a law improvement committee bill.
Yeah.
And it was the intent of the law improvement committee to introduce 343 and 245 in the past. So it's the third, the repeal of those
sections. So it's not really a conflict.
No.
Okay. The only thing that we have left to consider on 245 is whether you want to insert this amendment that's been presented to us by Representative Hansel in regards to the law library fees to extend that to district court filing. And it would be a certain amount in here. Determined under 21,350, and all that says is there'll be no greater than 40%.
But they had a 50-cent fee in the district court.
They apparently don't have a law library
no,
fee.
No, but I kind of thought one of the members had a fee.
Could I ask him? Whenever you're done with these amendments, I'd like to ask one quick question on this bill.
It doesn't set. It just says, as determined, it shall be no more than 40%, so they're going to leave it up to the county court.
Is this the right bill to put these amendments in?
Well, we probably, what do you think? Can we get it into it?
Are you going to amend it otherwise?
Well, we had that other amendment that, in fact, we adopted it, didn't we?
Yeah, the two amendments that were suggested by Mr. Smith.
That's right.
So the bill has to be engrossed anyway.
No, it has to be engrossed.
Relating to procedures concerning certain persons and their property, including but not limited to provision of probate of estate. You're going to get the district court thing in it.
I don't know. I'd say we'd have to change the timing. I think maybe we ought to look somewhere else.
Yeah, let's find out.
You should put it in the fair dismissal.
Could I ask a real quick
question? Go ahead, quick.
If I could ask Judge Gibson, when we were talking the other day about in small states, the 4 months that was necessary for a time period for notice, I guess anyone who would be interested or have a possible interest, what would be, you mentioned due process and the problems involved, but what would be the actual problem if you reduce that to 3 months or 2 months?
I don't know that there would be any real problem. There's no particular magic in 4 months. It does take a little time to marshal the assets, and it does take a little time for creditors to learn them the proceedings. But I don't think that it would make too much difference to you, Bob.
Except for the newspaper, it's probably
inheritance tax record.
And somehow it's not really critical.
You have to settle with the inheritance tax division before you can close it anyway, so that's no problem.
No.
This is the thing that keeps your estate open more than anything else does. And you're trying to get a relation inheritance
tax. Yeah, we've got to get that clear. Our average now is running just between 5 and 6 months on a week try to get management clear. You can try as hard as you can, and there still will be.
If you get hung up somewhere, it isn't your fault.
So there's a need for the 4 months?
I'm not saying that. I agree with Bob. You could have a 15 days and still wind up taking roughly 4 to 6 months to close it.
Now, there is a provision, you know, in the existing probate code where if it is a small estate and the spouse is the beneficiary and the minor children, you may close it summarily and set the whole estate aside to the spouse and minor children. You don't have to wait at all. I don't really think there's any particular need to shorten the time that's in the code. I don't think it'd do any particular harm, but I don't see any particular need.
Thank you. Ready
to vote? I would like to ask Judge Dixon just once more about this.
Attention, please. Judge Dixon, we have a question for you.
I just had another question. With respect to the amendments that we've already, in effect, approved on this language, cause to be delivered or mailed on Section 25, is it your opinion that those are essential amendments?
No, I don't think so. They're worthwhile, but rather than prejudice the passage of the bill, I would ignore them.
Shall deliver or mail. I wonder if we gain that much by changing that to cause to be delivered or mailed.
No, I told you his reasoning, and I can find no fault with his reasoning, but if I were a legislator and I was acting on it, I'd consider the substance of this bill far more important than the housekeeping amendment.
I don't think we should amend it.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to recommend to the committee that reconsider that.
You wish to withdraw the amendment?
Yes.
All right. The objection? Ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Ready to vote on the bill?
So move.
Do pass the floor. Move 245 to the floor. Do pass. Clerk, call the roll. Carried and has consent. If it doesn't make it, self carried. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time and attention.
Good work.
Thank you.
Claudia, you've been real patient. We'll look at 29:27. And we have some amendments in front of you that look like this.
Yeah. Okay. Claudia Burton.
Would you like a motion to table?
Claudia tells us what she's done. Where's the amendment?
I'll go with you.
It's right in your stack of materials there that was on in front of you.
These are from Lewis B. Hansen.
All right, Claudia, would you explain your amendments, please? They're self-explanatory, but go ahead. Okay. It's a new bill, really. Let me identify myself for the record. I'm Claudia Burton of Salem, Oregon. Here in a curious sort of mixed capacity. Here initially at the request of the committee to apparently answer some questions with respect to what the state of the law was now with domicile. But combined with that, I should say, is a personal sympathy with what the bill attempts to accomplish. In any event, I came several times and I gathered that what I was asked to do was to put into proposed language a bill which would clearly limit the effect of this change to within the confines of Oregon, and that change is contained in Section 1, and then to spell out what I understand to be the gist of the law now anyway with respect to custody of minors, with perhaps one or two very minor changes, but simply spelling it out, and that language is contained in Section 2. The basic change, I suppose, really is in Section 1, which represents change from the common law being that domicile of a married woman was automatically that of her husband, and that the request, I think, the Equal Rights Alliance, Section 1 would make the fact that a woman was married irrelevant with respect to domicile. It would be determined by the same sort of subjective facts that would determine her domicile if she was not married.
Ms. McGrew? I'm somewhat confused, Claudia. Now, the women's livers are concerned with the domicile follows the man.
Mr. Chairman,
is that correct?
You might know one too. Now,
free speech, remember?
Yes, I believe so. Now, remember my sort of mixed position, but yes, I understand that to be the case, and that's my own objection, yes.
What would happen if you gave the partners a choice of following whichever gender they chose to determine domicile?
I lost it.
I'm damn upset about this kind of a bill. You know, all you're going to do is you're going to have husband and wife running legislative stations.
Cut down the campaign?
I don't think you're going to have that occur permanently. There's a genuine issue.
What I'm wondering about is, you know, Vera wants to be, have the women run the show, and so I was willing to let them, you know. You know, the thing up to the law reads to say they'll follow Bill McDowell or the white Twitter.
Well, I'm not willing to sell out.
May I respond seriously to Representative Magruder?
No. We could allow them to time of marriage to decide which party they follow in terms of.
What do you want to do with the bill?
I move we amend so that we accept Claudia Burton's amendment.
All right. The motion is to adopt the amendment.
I'd like to discuss it, if I may briefly. I think this is an excellent presentation of what the law should be. The only difference from existing law, as I see it, is that we make it clear that a woman doesn't have to go into the ruse of establishing a divorce domicile to have a domicile separate from her husband. There need not be an intent to go for a divorce. And I think the way it is right now, you foster divorce by requiring that she must have the intent to seek divorce in order to acquire a separate divorce. Separate domicile. I think this is a far better statute. It's realistic. It does not either destroy marriage or injure.
Is there objection to the amendment?
So ordered,
Mr. Chairman.
Magruder?
I move that Section 3 is necessary wherever it should be amended. And Don, you can draft it for me. I'm not going to do it today.
Beyond the scope of the bill.
No, it isn't if you're going to do it this way. What I want to do is say that the husband can't run in one district and the wife can't run in another district while they maintain the marriage relationship.
Why should there be a public policy against that kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't understand it.
Well, that's kind of like cheaper advertising.
No. For both great feedback on the ground.
I mean, you've got guys running around in houseboats from district to district running. Now you're going to have them. Their wife and one and the husband and another.
They have to live in that area for a year, right?
Yeah.
That's not germane because the deal's in the election law.
Mr. Chairman, I move the bill to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Further discussion. Let's call the roll. That's next session.
You could have your house on the county line, one party has domicile in one county and one in the other county.
And he does.
Well, that doesn't necessarily establish domicile, though. As a matter of fact, you have a house.
Yeah, but it's
a combination.
Who is here?
I don't understand.
Who
You don't want to carry it?
You want to carry it?
Thanks, Claudia.
I'll carry it.
Perhaps I'll carry it. 2816, we have someone here to...
Who's going to carry it?
Who can combine it with the minority report on the other
one? Why don't you, you can get your paragraph 3 on your minority report, and you might want to change the title.
It's going to take me a few days.
2816 is limiting inspection of medical records. 2816. Who's here?
Did you have some amendments on this? You didn't, did you?
No, I'm just here to answer any questions. I have two bills.
No, I'm not. He has to get it right out. By the time the report gets to them.
Dick and I both play fair and square, and he'll play fair and square.
You want to identify yourself for the clerk? Why don't you come on up?
We had a hearing on this bill on June 6th. Testimony was from Mr. Briggs.
Ken Briggs. And you may already, do they already have copies of this? No, they should.
I wasn't here, apparently. Does anyone remember the testimony?
What's the number of the bill?
2816. Mr. Chairman, I am Ken Briggs from the Mental Health Division. I came tonight to answer any questions that the committee might have.
What an effect does this do, real quick?
What it does is greatly restrict the availability of patient records in the mental health program to the public at large. What we're trying to do is protect the confidentiality of patient records in mental health.
What does this do with the public records bill we passed?
The public records bill specifically exempts this section of the ORS.
Okay.
What does this do as far as legal actions, either criminal or civil, are concerned, reaching the record?
It restricts the accessibility in criminal cases to only those specific provisions of the ORS that provide for access.
One of the things we discussed at the hearing, and I think Phil Roberts brought up a question along these lines, whether or not there would be any difficulty with respect to access to reports made by the Mental Health Division with respect to a mental disease or defect plea or a commitment where you had an examination to determine fitness to proceed in a criminal action. And in checking the criminal provisions, the responsibility provisions, for example, in the criminal code, specifically provide for reports to be made, either in the event of a temporary commitment to determine fitness to proceed, or in the case of an acquittal and a later commitment by the court, and that would involve some later diagnoses and reports. It clearly is not the intent of this bill to restrict those kind of reports, isn't that right?
That's right. It was our intention that they should not be.
Did this come from Human Resources or Direction?
No, this had a referral to us.
Referral?
Yeah. I think it was.
Prior referral.
We're a subsequent referral.
Yeah.
Does it get to a problem that you now have?
Yes, it does. Currently, our records are only protected in the state hospital program. Specifically, the statute calls for confidentiality only in the state hospital. We have many non-hospital programs now, including alcohol and drug programs, which we operate in Portland, and the 27 community mental health clinics around the state. And this bill extends that same confidentiality to those programs. It also
more clearly defines when records can be released and can't be released than the current statute. And the current statute, for example, says that the administrator can release the hospital records for good cause, and leaves quite a bit of room for interpretation. This bill specifically calls out when it can and can't release the records. That was an amendment that was made in the Human Resources Committee.
I'm done. Maybe you as a witness can answer. Under this bill, would a court have authority to order release or disclosure on any basis other than subsection 2 of section 2?
In those cases?
Other than that, would a court have? What I'm saying is, do you see any inherent power in the court, any discretion to order a disclosure? The case beyond these, maybe, what it amounts to.
Yes.
Special provision for the correction provision records.
Yeah, but excuse me, apart from that, I'm thinking of the typical case. You've got a case going in court, and it would be relevant. Would the records show, or would it be relevant, or they might leave relevant evidence? The only thing I'm worried about is whether we're straitjacketing ourselves in A and B of sub 3 on section 2. Don, do you share any concern? I mean, you've been there.
Well, I'm saying
well, I'm in water, and the question arises, you know, the mental capacity of an individual arises. It may be a civil action, maybe a criminal action. Let's take a civil action. Give us some harder facts. Huh? And I want to get at some records, and I can't get the consent of the patient, okay? I can't get the consent of the patient. I can't get, there's no way I can say, well, it can be released to medical personnel to meet a medical emergency. That's, you know, the trial isn't a medical emergency. And it's not related to scientific research, it's not program evaluation, it's not fiscal audit. But it still would be relevant to my trial. Does anyone have any fear about that? I have some worries about just turning off relevant evidence, taking away from the discretion of the court altogether.
If I may respond to that, there are some other specific statutes that deal with court-ordered examinations that we believe this bill does not conflict with nor restrict. But in an ordinary case, civil or criminal, where those statutes didn't govern, and we wanted to introduce the records as evidence, it's our intent that they would be restricted and not be able to be introduced in evidence.
I think the one that Don alluded to at the hearing was the sexual, the old 137
dangerous offender.
Yeah.
The dangerous offender would be covered, we feel, and you would be able to get those records.
Yeah, dangerous offender specifically provided for.
The report coming
the
back.
The report comes back there. Just as it comes back in the case of a mental disease or defect under responsibility.
Okay. Good.
But in your case, your hypothetical, where it's a civil case, and for some reason you think this record might help you, I don't think you can get it.
No, I'm not under this statute. It's our intent to limit it.
The difficulty is where you've got a guardianship contest, something like that. You're trying to show someone is unfit and it's been established. The individual does not give consent, you know, there's no way you can get it. It's not a criminal case, and you're just locked. That worries me a little bit.
Would it be available in all the criminal cases, or just in the second, you know?
Just in the criminally dangerous, or where there was a plea of insanity in a criminal case, or in any other case, I believe, where the person whose records that you're after is a party to the case and testifies in his own behalf, I believe would be interpreted as giving consent.
Now, if you have an involuntary commitment, this would not bar use of the records of the commitment.
No, it would not.
This would just bar your records as to what occurred after the commitment.
After we got.
Does this require a release of the records to the patient to request?
It provides for release with the patient's consent under any case. And
if he came in and asked for them, would he get them?
Yes.
How do you intend to enforce the fines of this?
That's a good question. I hadn't really thought through that one. The reason that that's in there is twofold. One is that we feel that there should be some definite result for a release beyond just filing a civil case for damages.
Who's going to fine? Who's going to levy the fine? How are you going to collect it? I think there probably should be something that speaks to that. Bob Marsh made a suggestion on page 3, line 27. The word or upon order of the court of competent jurisdiction are now used with respect to the limited correction division records.
Right.
Okay. Would you have any objection to using that as a subsection C?
Yes, I would.
You would have objection. Over on the other. Can we draw it? Suppose we said. Well, the typical is a guardianship situation. You know, well, I had to come up. We represent the guardian of a minor ward, and the ward mother was killed in an automobile collision, and the father, the ward, living in Alaska, he comes down and we fight over the guardianship. And it turns out that he has, you know, all kinds of, I won't give the name of the case, although it's a public record, I don't think it's appropriate to give the name. We had all kinds of contentions about his ability and his stability, you know. And if we could have gotten that, you know, records of his treatment, it would have been helpful. We couldn't. There's no way. The result of the matter was, the court gave the presumption to him, the child went with him. The man has since gone through 3 additional marriages, and the child busted from here to here to here to here to here. You see, that's just one example. I'm not saying that the records would have persuaded the court, but there's that kind of a question that I think is a good one. You know, where does the interest of the child rest versus the interest of the parent in having this frustrated? Is the court a fact-finding process? Is it designed to reach the truth, or is it not? And admittedly, there's a balance. That's true. Yeah.
But, Bob, don't you think there's a need for something that would allow getting these things in a civil case under certain conditions?
Maybe if we put in, I want to think about where I think we can reach a compromise on.
Well, my main concern is that we don't simply allow them to go out, but a court usually uses pretty good discretion in order to allow them to go out.
Suppose you put in here that a person who is a party to a proceeding is presumed to have consented, or by becoming a party consent. That would be because it won't have to be the one I just gave you. Because, you mentioned that if a person testified, there would be. You would interpret that as consenting. Would you be willing to go along with that?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do that. Is that fair enough?
Have you got someplace in the middle?
What do you mean?
If the individual whose records
are in the custody of what is it now called, health division,
testifies on the matter of mental health or wellness, whatever, then those records would be relevant or admissible.
I think that would be acceptable. If in a court case, the party who had been in our program did testify on the issue, then I would clearly think that would be consent.
Do you want to say it again, please?
I do think that would be a reasonable compromise, that if the person who is a party
to an issue in court, testifies to that particular issue that's relevant to his record, then I would think that would be giving consent to examination of the record. Or that we could write an amendment in here that would provide that. That would, I think, not violate the intent of this law. And take care of the kind of cases that you're talking about.
It wouldn't go as far as I think we might go in some cases, but on the other hand, I recognize there's a legitimate interest in protecting the business. Is there some way to word that simply, John? Or do you see any problem with that from a technician's point of view?
Oh, no, we could draft something and go in there, sure.
I really assumed that would already be the case.
I heard you say that.
So on court order, if the patient is a party and appears as a witness, something of that nature, is that the idea?
Exactly. Real quick.
You want that as a sub C to 3?
Yeah.
Page 2. In regards to this fine business, apparently the mere designation of a fine brings it within the violation section of the criminal code. So it would be a violation of that code, and it would be a criminal matter to that extent.
As long as we're amending this bill.
That's with our intent.
Although we might make, if we're going to amend it,
we might just classify this as a violation. Now that would drop, if we say it's a violation, then that drops the fine down to $250.
Yes, one of the reasons that I put that specific fine in is because it conforms to federal law on release of patient information in drug programs that are supported with federal funds.
Okay, now, your entitlement to the federal funds depend upon an equivalent state penalty.
No,
okay. I like your idea of making the violation.
I think $250.
$5,000 really isn't very realistic. Do you think? I mean, is it? You think it's? You're going to get a court to impose a $5,000 fine for this kind of a. I mean, is that important to you to have that stiff penalty?
We want a substantial penalty, but
we want
a chilling
effect.
We're going to can the guy anyway.
And to say for.
Our employees
are leaking in information.
Yeah.
So there's a extremely strong feeling in the human resources and the relevant sections of our North Carolina. They're leaking stuff, right and left.
Well, who are they leaking to?
That's unconscionable. I had no idea.
So if you charge somebody with a violation for the first offense, are you going to retain them in your employ?
No. Not once this bill goes into effect.
Right now you can't do it.
Pretty custom.
That's not grounds for to discharge them. It is.
Okay, I understand the amendment. Any other?
Do you want to just read? Have this read then? Commits a violation. Is that agreeable?
Come in right
now. How about the second?
Well, we're trying to cover people that are knowingly obtaining the information.
This covers both.
As well as those who are releasing. And they may not be our employees. It might be somebody who walks in off the street.
Then we'll add in the court, on court order.
Okay,
if the patient is a party to the.
Well, then I'll amend subsection 2 of section 3 on page 3 to read that the person commits a violation.
I can't understand
why you shouldn't do it any time that a court would give a court order, because the court isn't going to do that frivolously.
Oh, I agree with you. That may deal with.
I can back out of my deal if you're going to
be
ready.
The implication is the
witness.
I don't
know. I tend to go the other way.
Upon court.
You don't agree with what I said.
I agree personally with this.
Well, I'm going with
practically, I just don't see how we can sway Vera, and we've got to live with the division itself.
I'm fine, I'm having a car from there.
They do draw somewhat.
Well, I think they understand the reason.
Any objection to the amendment? So ordered. Do you take any action on the bill?
Move to floor with due pass recommendation.
Mr. Marks moves House Bill 2816 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Lund.
Aye.
Hanson.
Aye.
Yes.
Look at how reasonable we are.
Alright. Put on unanimous consent if it comes off, Mrs. Cass will carry.
We are oozing with reason.
23. Well, you look at HJR 17.
Where's the brass?
Would my advice, you have some further names?
Yeah, HJR 17. Missouri plan.
There we go.
I might inform the committee that SJR 33, which is about the same idea, I guess, on the Senate side, came out of committee and then got sent back and is still languishing there.
Where is it?
And we have some amendments which limit the bill to just the appellate court, as I understand, the appellate courts and the tax courts.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm Levi Smith, the Executive Secretary of the Judicial Reform Commission. Let me explain why I'm here tonight, if I may. I'm not really here to urge the committee to necessarily adopt amendments proposed by the Judicial Reform Commission. It just seems like it would be helpful in light of HJR 17, what I'll call Representative Hansel and Paulus's bill being before this committee, that we at least inform the committee what type of amendments would bring HJR 17 in the line with SJR 33, which, as you indicated, is in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so I helped Don in the preparation of some amendments which apparently are in some conformity with the feelings expressed by this committee when they had a public hearing on the bill, and also are in conformance with what happened in the Senate Committee.
Well, my thought is, if it's of any interest to the committee at all, we might see if we can amend it, pass it out, and maybe that'll encourage the Senate to...
Who are the architects of the Senate resolution?
Well, at the sponsorship of the Judicial Reform Commission, or the request, the Senate Judiciary Committee sponsored the bill. They did amend the original bill, however, to limit it to appellate courts and the tax court. We originally had all trial courts. HJR 17, what you have before you, includes the circuit courts also. So I've got three sets of amendments, and I'll very quickly tell you about those. One is simply to bring the numbers up to snuff with the six-person jury constitutional provision enacted at the last election. We did add a section at that election to the...
Can you refer to your amendments now? We've got,
yes, well,
we've got,
let's see. I
one set of two pages and then the one you just gave.
The one I just gave you, which is the one pager, brings the numbers up to snuff. It reflects the existence now of a Section 9 in the Constitution so that the numbers become 10 through 14 instead of 9 through 13. That's purely bookkeeping.
If we adopt these, I'd like to have a measure summary say, it brings the numbers up to snuff. I love that.
That's certainly no reflection on the draftsmanship of HJR 17, which you have before you. We made the same mistake with SJR 33. We just forgot that the new section came in last fall. The second amendment deletes circuit courts from the merit selection and retention provisions of the measure, and that, I believe, is the two-pager, with the front page looks like this. The second page tells you how Section 1 of H.J.R. 17 would read with those amendments included. And it would then read that only judges of the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the Tax Court should be governed by the continuing provisions of the measure. It makes one other change, which simply straightens out some language about ensuring that the compensation of all judges cannot be diminished during the term for which they are elected or selected or retained. There's a little grammar problem with H.J.R. 17 in regard to which judges have that protection for their compensation level. If you read the last sentence of Section 1 of H.J.R. 17, you see that they don't cover all judges. So that's the change that that amendment would make.
All judges constitutionally have that protection.
Yes, but H.J.R. 17 would take it away from some of them, and we're showing that amendment to give it back. Then the last little group of amendments have to do with the composition of the Judicial Nominating Commission, and these are kind of a matter of taste. They're simply based on what the Judicial Reform Commission started with and what the Senate Judiciary Committee did to us, and I present them to you simply so you can see their point of view. They would have changed Section 9 of H.J.R. 17 to reflect that the Judicial Nominating Commission, as now contained in H.J.R. 17, should first suffer the deletion of the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals from membership on that commission. I happen to know that the Chief Judge feels he should be deleted. Number one, he's not tickled pink about the fact that he would not be eligible for elevation to the Supreme Court if he's contained on that commission. And number two, there's some general feeling that it kind of loads the thing up with appellate judges to have both the Chief Justice and the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals. However, there's always a price for getting rid of a lawyer on a commission, and so the other changes which the Third Amendment would make to the composition of that commission are the addition of the president of the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar and one other lawyer chosen by the Board of Governors of the Oregon State Bar. So the final amendment which I presented to you would end up with an 8-member nominating commission, three of whom would have to be lawyers, the Chief Justice, the President of the Bar, and one other lawyer, three of whom would have to be laymen selected by the governor, and two of whom would come from the legislature and might or might not be lawyers. So there would be a 3-5, 4-4, or 5-3 lawyer, non-lawyer composition of that commission. Those are the amendments which we distributed tonight. You've, of course, had your public hearing and on H.J.R. 17. I'd be happy to tell you about the testimony in the Senate or answer any questions.
Could I ask two questions, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Brown.
My first being in law school, in our what was it, legal professions class, my professor indicated that when attorneys recommend a lawyer to be appointed to judgeship, often it's a popularity contest of attorney choosing. Looks to me like we're replacing a popularity contest with all the citizens choosing for a popularity contest with attorneys choosing. You might comment on that. My second question, what's the theory for saying that district and circuit court judges would be elected, but higher court judges would be going through this other process?
Well, I think the theory, and we've heard many theories expressed, number one, it's rather difficult to contrive truly significant issues upon which candidates for appellate office can conduct a popular campaign. Number two, they are so removed from the people in their locality, they run on a statewide basis, that the expense of a campaign, the trying to conduct that campaign, the inability to really muster any issues before an electorate for appellate offices simply means that the people don't get to make a very intelligent choice about appellate races. And the distinction is, the feeling was that the circuit and district judges, hopefully, they do have some closer ties to their local communities, and that a popular election makes more sense in regard to them. There was strong feeling that it doesn't make sense in regard to any judges, and in support of that feeling were the type of thing that there's no guarantee that a good judge is a good politician. And also the problem of a candidate for a judicial office having to go to lawyers for money, lawyers who will later appear in front of him. All the standard arguments that were aired by the commission.
Those arguments
were
made.
Mr.
McGruder?
I have special leave of the group to continue debate despite the voting table. I don't have enough time. Is that it? How can I deprive you of it? I don't know what the status of it. Where is the Senate major?
Okay, the Senate major came out of committee with a due pass recommendation. The vote on the floor was 14 in favor. There was a motion for reconsideration was carried. It went back to the Senate Judiciary Committee, where there is now some question as to what amendments will be necessary to get it out again, and it certainly isn't going to come out until there can be some assurances as to what the vote on the floor would be.
Would we be well advised to follow the Senate's lead on this?
In regard to the possible amendments you would make to the one in front of you?
And what I'm wondering, where to string up another storm without any real productivity that could issue from it?
Well, I would say, Representative Hansen, that you'd be well advised to delete the circuit judges in terms of what kind of saleability it has later. That was a big hang-up with our original proposal in the Senate, that we had the circuit and district judges in there.
There's another side to this. We're trying to get them to buy 2905, which is a great way of remaking the power. Okay.
You're doing terrible things to it, too, I understand.
Yeah, well, they're barely recognizable. But I'm told they're going for it. The Supreme Court makes the rules of the special low group and get beat them to the legislature and see how they like it next time. Okay, I'll say the legislature what. But if I, trying to sell 2905, say, aha, would the seven elected Supreme Court justice lead us astray? Now, if I'm trying to sell it on the thesis that they're elected, and we just suddenly pull the election from them, it takes away some of my trust in trying to get them to have the rulemaking power. That's one of the worries I have. Do you have any way of giving me any comfort on this?
No, other than you can interject responsiveness to the will of the people into almost every issue in the world, and I heard them interject that into the debate on 2905 and a little flabbergasted, but I guess if they're going to raise that issue, they're going to raise it.
I'm willing, Representative Hansen, to give you a little comfort. I'll defer my motion while you make the motion to table.
We're not ready to move on.
McGruder moves to table HDR 17. Clerk, call roll.
Dunn?
Aye.
Hansen?
Aye.
Nass?
Aye.
McGruder?
Aye.
Mark?
No.
Dunn?
No.
No, it didn't make it. It failed.
Okay, I move that middle amendment, whatever it is.
The one that's on the tax court of appeals and Supreme Court.
Takes away the circuit judge's position.
Yeah.
They're still left.
But you have to move the amendment. The amendment, the two-page amendment, right? Two-page amendment. Any objections?
Yes.
Clerk, call the roll.
No.
Hansen?
Aye.
Cass?
No.
McGruder?
No.
Mark?
Aye.
Dulles?
Aye.
Fine. Have you got on both then?
Well, we tried. We gave it every conceivable shape.
You got reference.
All right, we
got
to change the vote.
Paul,
get the
name on the thing. Yeah.
Amendment's adopted. Amendment's adopted.
I changed my vote.
Okay.
How about this one? The one that changes, that brings it up to snuff.
Oh, we'll go for that.
Is there any objection to the snuff amendment?
Adopt.
So order.
There we go with snuff. How about the last set of amendments about the composition of the nominating committee? You don't like those?
Which one?
Well, the other one's amending section 9.
Well, changing the makeup?
Yeah.
Any motion on that one?
Of the nominating committee.
Well, where do we stand? Do you want to put it on the catapult and send it to the floor, or do you want to just let it lie here and rise?
It's not going to make it on the floor.
Did it pass in the House last session?
Yeah, it did. And it's unfortunate. It's been so long since our hearing on this, really, because most of the testimony we heard was favorable for this. And the reason we held this so long was to wait to see what the Senate was going to do because of SJR 33.
Was this heard on the day I went down to Newport and told you?
I couldn't answer that. I can't. I feel like Jim McGruder. I don't know what I was doing. What I was doing on that today.
I don't know what I read.
You wish to take any action on the third set of amendments? You can leave the.
That's the composition amendment. No, I don't care.
Okay. Wish to vote on the bill?
We don't have enough votes.
You had to vote out.
We got two.
I'm willing to send any turkey along to people to vote on.
That's of course all you do. You don't make any law. You put it on the ballot.
But they say that the death penalty.
Yeah. We can use that argument on me.
Levi, how many states have this type of system now?
No, at least 13, maybe 15.
Is Indonesia?
Missouri.
Yeah, we know Missouri does. Yeah.
Missouri has a pretty fractured version, actually.
Yeah. Well, we apparently don't have the vote, so we'll move on.
Okay. That
brings me to 10.
I
want
to go to 10.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. While we're here, let's look at HJR 77.
And the record control, in response to the chairman's suggestion, I am prepared to speak. And every chairman has a little credit.
77?
Yeah, this is Norma's bill to repeal a provision in the Oregon Constitution which provided for veterans bonuses because all the bonds are paid off.
Didn't we move this out once?
No, we just approved.
We introduced the bill.
You
approved the introduction of the bill.
I moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
How come I don't get money in my book?
Yeah, it's just under.
The last red tab
in your book.
Oh, wait a minute.
No, the last red tab.
HJR 77, which repeals the veteran bonus.
HJR. Already on the bad side of my
book. All the bonds are paid off.
Moving for due pass.
We don't need it anymore.
It made all the lines up. It's an old.
Third call the roll on due pass.
Thanks.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. If it doesn't make it, what Norma carry it?
I've got that wired as a real campaign issue next time, and I'm glad that I'm right on it.
I got my ear to the ground.
I really hate to.
Your representative repealed the veterans.
I really hate to do this to the committee. You want to vote on the guest passenger bill again?
Please.
2328?
Oh, we don't have
a
vote?
Yeah, we
can
vote on it.
Okay, come on in.
Magruder
coming
in. No, you better hold up.
Tell you what I'm going to do, Lou.
Tell you what I'm willing to do. In the name of fairness, to show how I want this committee, I have here.
I'll go with
him. I wouldn't trade a
Tell you
what, it'll help clean it up. We can take things off the table, can't we?
Yeah.
Okay?
If you can get the vote.
I should know. I'm going to rise above principle. I move to table.
Clerk, call the roll. Pass the
I don't think you have to do that.
Clerk, call the roll. Table on 23-28.
Uh-oh.
I think you can get it off. Aye.
Ham.
Aye.
Jack.
No.
Mark.
No.
Joe.
What difference is it?
You have to get the roll call.
Well, I'll tell you what, when Norm comes back, I will just send that little bitty shooting off to the floor with a dude.
Yeah, where is Norm
well,
all the time on all these?
You
yeah.
Better complete the roll.
Aye.
Aye. We haven't got enough. With a dude pass. D-E-W.
How do you do that?
When we get Norm.
Okay, $23.99. We tried this before, it didn't work. Provides that any party filing an action to a proceeding consents to examination of himself.
Oh, no, wait a minute. No,
no.
That's on there for a different reason. I was asked to draft some amendments to pick up those the husband and wife situation that was.
Well, let's take that up some other time then, huh?
Okay.
Well, it's really not very complicated.
All right, explain it to us.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why.
This is. Was just meant to be a vehicle to pick up these amendments to 139.320. So obviously I have to amend the title, but it still relates to confidential communication. And this was a situation that was presented by the district attorney of Benton County, Brown. And
the wife that couldn't testify.
Right.
The husband that did something to the daughter.
Right.
The adoption of the amendments.
Because he'd done something to the daughter. There's a provision where he can testify under those.
He was an adult child.
Yeah, it was an adult. And
yeah,
under those circumstances,
you
couldn't use
the
statute.
You
couldn't use
the
statute. And so you've got two situations. You've got the situation where you want to provide that the spouse is a competent witness, and then you've got a situation where not only are they competent, but they're compellable, and you can subpoena the witness and require them to testify.
Mom, you got a lot of compassion.
And so sub one is really already in the statute. Sub two is the new provision, husband or wife shall not be compelled against his or her accused spouse unless, subject to the provisions of sub 3, the witness spouse gives his or her consent. But then sub 3 says, any criminal action in which the defendant's spouse is accused of an unlawful act committed against a minor child of either or both of the parties, the spouse of the defendant may be compelled to testify against the accused in such cases, and the reference to 44040, the privileged communication statute does not apply.
Can I ask a question?
Answer.
I mean, even though this solves a problem, doesn't it really do violence to the philosophy behind the husband-wife privilege? In other words, the whole purpose of that privilege, for me to have the privilege of my communication with my wife being private, is the idea that I'm going to be able to prevent her from saying those things, or publishing that in court, and that I can feel thus the freedom to completely disclose with complete candor and thus enhance that marital relationship. And I believe that is a valid policy just as much now as it was earlier.
Well, I think that the issue of the term might not be more, because I've had cases where this very issue, I had a defense lawyer say, when I called the wife, she told me she was going to testify against the husband who charged with rape on the daughter, on the stepdaughter. Yeah, she was going to testify. It's her daughter. And the whole thing. She got up there and she decided not to. No way you can compel her.
Well,
got a minor child. No way in the Lord's green earth. And yet that child is, you know, just.
But balanced against that is the whole question of the ability to have a complete candor in the marriage relationship and to protect through the law that relationship. And I believe it's still balanced.
Sacrifice a great principle there. You can make one bump. Thank you.
Now, I feel differently. I just don't have any sympathy with the wife who must protect that kind of marriage. No, there are two aspects, but I agree. One is the communication, and the other is the mere fact you testify. You see, you have both aspects involved in there. So the can spouse testify to communication made by defendant's spouse, and can spouse testify to conduct that are just anything else against the defendant's spouse.
But
these amendments would make it that the competent witness against the other in any criminal case.
And why couldn't this principle spill over to the attorney-client, the doctor-patient, veterinary?
That's what's compellable, I think, Bob, only in the second degree. In other words, if spouse wants to testify against the other,
Sub 1 is already in the statute. Sub 1, if you'll look at the part of 139.320 that's being deleted, it says in all criminal actions in which the husband is a party.
No, but this says compelled or allowed.
The wife is a competent witness.
Yeah, but neither husband or wife in such cases shall be compelled or allowed unless they consent of both of them.
And that's where the question rule would be based on the cases I've had.
Is that right? But they consent of both of them.
Either can prevent. That's where the court of rule night, they literally applied the oral out.
Yeah. I sense you don't have a book.
Well, it looks as though we don't. Which brings us directly to the subject of Bill number 2982.
You want to take up 2982?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, you have no idea. My heart is leaping and bounding for joy.
That'll be the last bill tonight.
Okay.
Okay, let's take it.
You have before you 2982.
Take 45 minutes?
No, it won't take that long. I've gone through it. Okay, do you recall we have sought consent on this whole thing? Try to simplify, so I've gone through and pruned even first. I thought it might hurt a little, but the consensus of the others was no, it wouldn't hurt those. So here goes. Define consumer goods, consumer transactions, because in both those cases, no attachment. You recall it when your consensus that we allow the club in that situation, but no attachment.
Okay.
Section 2. On page 2, describes what you put in the petition or affidavit as the form statement. And this, again, is pruned way down. Page 3, section 3, it lays out very clearly three prohibitions. And I made a correction on your copies there. Except under subsection, or under section 5, no court shall issue provisional process to effect attachments where you have the two, consumer goods or consumer transactions. Now you can use attachment only for the Penoy versus Neff quasi-in-rem circumstance, even in those situations. That's the only. Next, the court has to make a finding, which is described in the next section, before it can issue any order for provisional process. And finally, no provisional process can issue without a specific application. So the court is going to willy-nilly decide, well, I think this would be a good thing. The reason they do this is to tie the plaintiff through to the liability for a wrongful use of the act. And I think it will work out pretty well. In section 4, the court is required first to consider the affidavit, which lays it out. Next, in subsection 2 of section 4, the court then makes this finding, and we change the word here. It's actually more wordy than I would want it to be, but it makes the other lawyers feel happy, and they are of such competence and skill that I think we should give them some deference. So, the finding is that there is probable cause for sustaining the validity of the underlying claim. Of course, this locks right into the Supreme Court case. It's adequate, and I think covers it very well. Then the court, having made that finding, turns to the question of restraining order, show cause order, or provisional process. Section 5, Penoy versus Neff, quasi in the RAM situation. And again, this is cut way down from what it was. Section 6 is the bulk sales situation, and that's cut way down from what it was. Section 7 is the pre-filing waiver by the defendant. And what that means is that in security agreements to be negotiated in the future, there probably will be placed in these agreements very conspicuous words. That's one, either conspicuous words or a handwriting of the defendant, by which the defendant acknowledges that these rights are given up. And of course, this ties in with language in the 20s case. The court recognizes this may occur. It's very clear that the defendant knows that that's what's happening. In section 8, you have provision for a restraining order. Not a restraining. You have a.
No,
Section 8, you have a provision which the court again in point 8 alluded to, where you have clear evidence that without immediate attachment or replevin, something bad is going to happen. Destruction, serious harm, concealment, removal from the state, or transfer to missing persons. Then you can get the court, on application, only as a plaintiff against, can issue this immediate authority for the attachment or the replevin or other conditional process. It's usually going to be attachment or replevin. Section 9. The restraining order provision, and again, this restraining order can concur with it, can issue at the same time as an order to show cause. And again, this gives flexibility to the plaintiff, so the plaintiff will not reach for the moon when he shouldn't. The plaintiff is really can live with a restraining order, that's all he should go for, and he'd be better off to do it, rather than trying to go out and get an immediate authority to have the court go out and pick up the goods, either under an attachment or a replevin. And Section 10 is the show cause order when you're going to go ahead. You're not going to have an immediate pickup. You're going to ask the court to tell the defendant to come into a hearing and let's take a look. Is there probable validity of the underlying claim? That's what Section 10 is all about. Also provides for what minimally what the order shall contain. I cut that way down from what some of the other drafts. And sub 4 provides for what happens if you can't find the defendant, serve the defendant with a show cause order or with a restraining order, but you can find the people who have actual possession or control of the property. You can get an order against them from disposing of the property while you're still out shopping around for the defendant. For Section 11, you have the provision where the defendant, after being served with a show cause order, decides he wants to throw in the towel. He probably runs off to his lawyer, shows the lawyer his card, that is, the facts of the situation. And the lawyer says, look, son, don't pay me $300 to go in there and fight that for you, okay, at this show cause hearing. You sign this paper which says these things, we'll send it in, let him come pick up your goods, and that'll save you a lot of money. And that's what Section 11 is designed to do. I think I alluded to that in an earlier explanation in an earlier draft. Section 12 tells what the court does at the hearing. If the court makes the findings, then the court goes ahead and issues an order for provisional process. And sub 2 says that if the court doesn't think provisional process is in order, it can still go ahead and issue a restraining order, which is really what everybody would like. It's not just that.
So it can be commenced in either district or circuit court.
Any court, which otherwise has the power to affect attachment or replevin, and that's either court. Or potentially even in a justice's court, but it's not so likely to be there, because I think a justice of the peace would just
sort of hand and run.
Broadway's mine.
Yeah.
Did you have a question?
No, I just kind of moved the adoption of the amendment.
Okay, is there objection to the adoption of the amendment? Move the bill as amended before the due pass. Further discussion. Yes. Mr. Mark.
I understand that, according to Lou, that the present statutes are kind of really null. Because of the court's decision that
we cannot proceed under them. They lie there dormant because there isn't a preliminary procedural.
Does this really change any practice?
This puts an upfront.
Or does it codify what's happening? Is everyone going by the?
Some of the courts, our firm, and I suppose Bob has said it, we have gone to some courts and used a procedure very like this and gotten the court to issue attachment. We've done it in only two cases I know of. It's very hard to do. Most of the courts won't do it because they say, hold it, unless the statute prescribes the procedure, we the court can have it in our time. Okay.
Are there some, your amendments don't make any reference to any.
That's right.
They purposely existing statutes.
They do make internal reference only, but not any in the title, because there is no amendment or
no repealers, no amendments.
No. And it was felt that once you start into those, you're going to undertake a massive revision the way California did. And what I plan to do is, if this passes, I plan to write the Bar Committee on Procedure and Practice and ask them to undertake a study and submit it to the 75 session legislature the way the California people did. California has a real problem because their courts have just gone ape. they started to pull away their rule invalid all their in court lien laws. Then, you know, you can't have an in court lien, no mechanic lien without a preliminary hearing, and it's just a turmoil. So the California legislature in a real debacle. They even put a limiting date on their statute. Our courts have not done that. Our courts have been very, I think,
per the rule on the four amendments. Do pass.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries unanimously. I don't know where to put
I think it's probably
what
you're talking about.
Carry it. We're adjourned. Thank you for staying.